Before takeoff checklist complete, this is Aviator Cast, episode 45.
Calling all aviators, pilots, and aviation lovers. Welcome to Aviator Cast, where we close the gap between real aviation and flight simulation. Climb aboard, buckle up, and prepare for takeoff. Here's your host, Chris Palmer.
Welcome, 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 aviators. You've landed at Aviator Cast. My name is Chris Palmer. Years ago, as a young boy, I started out with this aviation thing by being fascinated with simulation. As I grew, so did my love for all things flying. Eventually, I'd be flying for real, getting a true taste for flight. Simulation, real flight, and my general love for aviation all contribute to this passion of mine, as I'm sure may be the case with even you. I'm the founder and owner of Angle of Attack, a video flight training company, which is bringing you this podcast today. Aviator Cast is a weekly podcast where we talk about the spirit of the aviator. We believe flying is an art form, one that we have to continually practice and master. This mastery is gained through a focus on continual learning, human factors, humility, and a commitment to excellence. Show notes, transcript, community discussion, and links for this episode can be found by simply going to aviatorcast.com. So welcome to this, the 45th episode of Aviator Cast. It is my pleasure to welcome you here and to have you be a part of this wonderful community. So I have a great interview lined up for you guys. I know that a lot of you simulation or flight simulator guys are going to love this podcast today because we have a fantastic developer on the show with us, and I'll share exactly who that is in a few moments here. First, we have a review, and this is a great one. I really like this one. This comes from Anis Azcool, and he gives us 5 stars. He says, "Keep up the amazing work you're doing." That's his title. He says, "Hey, Chris, my name is Anis, and I'm from Syria and currently living in Istanbul. I'm a flying lover and a simulator enthusiast, but I couldn't reach my dream of becoming a pilot because of the war tearing our country apart. I just want to tell you, when I listen to your podcast, I feel like I'm a real aviator. I can feel your passion, same as mine, and same as the people leaving your reviews on this podcast. Not to make it so long, I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for this, and I really mean your podcast and your AOA is super awesome. Keep up this passion, my friend, and thank you again." Anis, thank you so much for your review, and thank you for being part of our community. And you're right, there are many out there that are just like you that really have this passion for flight, and I'm absolutely excited to hear that you're with us, coming all the way from Istanbul, and that you are enjoying aviation through simulation. So it's great to have you, and thank you so much for the heartfelt message. That's very much appreciated. So if you want to leave a review, kind of like Anis here, you can go ahead and do that on iTunes. That is the primary source to leave a review, and that lets others know about the podcast and that it is something worth going and listening to. So if you do enjoy this episode, please go there. If you do nothing else, and leave a review for us. We'd really appreciate that. And subscribe. Why not? So today I have a fantastic episode lined up for you guys. I have Scott Gentile from A2A Simulations with us. Now, Scott started with A2A Simulations a very long time ago. He's kind of the face of A2A Simulations. He's not necessarily the CEO or anything like that, but he's mainly the face, does a lot of work with the company. I think he's kind of their main guy, but Scott is quality driven. And I mean, this guy takes simulations to a whole new level that you wouldn't imagine. He does that by doing what are called add-on aircraft, taking a software package in and of itself, throwing that into Microsoft Flight Simulator or Prepared, and that simulation kind of standing on its own. So he essentially, you know, recently especially, they've created some very popular general aviation aircraft in the 172, the Cherokee, I believe, or the Comanche, one of the two, and the 182. these are top-notch, and I mean, they are crazy. You get all sorts of consequences for doing things wrong. They fly realistically, they handle realistically, they sound realistic. There's just so much immersion that goes into the simulation that you forget that you're actually in a simulation. And at the end of the day, that's what a great simulator does. You forget for several moments at a time that you are flying, not for real, but rather in a simulator. And that has tremendous consequences also for being a great training tool, not just sort of this entertainment tool that a lot of people use simulation for, but also a great way to learn the actual aircraft through simulation. So we're going to talk a lot about that with Scott, but we're also going to get to know him a little better and where his background kind of brought him up to this space in simulation. These guys are top-notch A2A simulations. I can't say enough good things about them, and I think you're going to get a feel for that in this interview. So enjoy. Here is Hangar Talk with Scott Gentile.
Now, a special Hangar Talk segment.
All right, everybody. We are honored to have a very special guest with us today, Scott Gentile. How are you doing, Scott?
Great.
Awesome. So, Scott, you are from A2A Simulations. You guys do absolutely stellar work in creating very high fidelity, very high quality general aviation aircraft, even some warbirds. You've done captain of the ship as well. We're going to get into all that. The first question I always ask of the people I'm interviewing is, how did you fall in love with aviation? So let's start there.
Well, it's probably the same with most of the people in aviation, I'd imagine. Most must have started like me at just very, very young age. I can't remember. I mean, it's going way back to earliest memories of just falling in love with airplanes, just flying over your house. But I remember as a kid, it was an enormously powerful draw. I mean, it was almost an obsession. You know, I think I had one large airplane book as a kid, and I just think about how many times I looked at that. It was a great book, actually. When I lost the book many years ago after, you know, growing up, and then I repurchased it. And you know, just I think it's in our DNA. I've said this many times. I do think we all share a common DNA in our blood, and that's the aviation gene. And for me, it's also closely tied to freedom, mm-hmm. Big freedom lover. And I think people who love to fly really are seeking the freedom that we get when we're flying. You know, you're way above the earth and you're flying. I mean, it's just there's something spiritual about flying airplanes that I think hits us at a very young age, and there's no turning away from it. You know, my brother's like most kids, guys at that age, he loves all mechanical stuff, but he kind of views airplanes like he views cars, like he views trains, that kind of stuff. But we don't view airplanes and cars the same, though a lot of us who love airplanes also do love automobiles. The airplane is it's a very special place.
Definitely. Did your parents fly or anything like that? Or who was your aviation mentor that kind of got you started in it all?
My father had a Cessna 120.
Oh, wow.
That was long before I was born. He lost his license because he was diabetic. So the license was yanked. And so by the time I was born, he hadn't flown for many years. But I always, as a kid, and he always supported my love for aviation. I have early memories of he'd drive me to the airport, and I remember going out in a twin. I don't remember what kind of twin it was. It must have been five or something. But I remember being in this twin or being in a. I do remember the first time I was in a small airplane with him, and it was probably a Cessna. I'm guessing it was a Cessna 172. And all I remember is my expectation was this was going to be a pristine machine. It was going to be just almost like a spaceship. I was expecting all these high-tech devices, and I was thinking, wow, this is going to be something. And I just remember seeing the pilot pulling out, I thought it was a choke, but he was actually, now I remembered, he was priming. But my grandfather used to have an old pickup truck, and he used to have to, I remember him always wrestling with that choke. And when this thing started, it's rattling, it's bucking. I remember looking around this thing, it was all beat up. I was actually not comfortable in that first flight. I was thinking, are you sure this thing is safe? And I was basically just, get me on the ground, because it was just, it felt like a bag of bolts. But it's funny, because that is what these small airplanes are. And in many ways, most airplanes in general, because they're built to be as light as possible, and they're designed to only have strength in those absolutely necessary areas. And anything that doesn't need it doesn't get it.
Exactly.
So they do tend to be a bag of bolts. And that's right. The beauty of it, because that's really what we're about. We capture the bag of bolts and rattling and all that stuff in our technology. Definitely.
I would say so. And we'll get to talk more about that, because I'm pretty excited about this new product you guys have out. How did you transition from, you know, being around aviation as a kid? Your father was obviously kind of into it. How did you transition from there into actually getting into actual flight training? So tell us that story.
When I was in my late 20s, you know, I always felt aviation was just out of reach financially. It's just, and that's one of the big problems we have in general aviation today,
right?
Is it just seems like something you only do if you obtain a certain degree of financial success. But in my late 20s, I was a musician. I was not making a lot of money. I wasn't married. It was just out there playing gigs, doing what a single guy does, not much responsibility. And I started doing the numbers, and I realized, geez, you know, I could afford to buy a little Piper. And I purchased a 1978 four-seat Piper Warrior. I didn't have much of a car. I mean, it was Pontiac Trans Am. I love that car to death, but I think I paid like $1,500 for the car, and I built it.
Right.
And it was just a small one-room apartment. But, you know, I could afford to buy the plane. What I didn't anticipate with that airplane were the bills from the maintenance. I really bad luck in that airplane. I mean, the Comanche that I own and operate right now, it's a fraction of the cost. It's just because it's now, I'm a very active owner. Anytime that plane is touched, it's either with my hands or it's with someone else's hands with me right there. It's much more affordable when you're involved, and also when you get a plane that's of good quality.
If I understand this correctly, you basically bought an airplane before you had your license. Did I get that right?
Yeah, I purchased the plane and was to train on it.
Okay.
And that, at least I had that right, because when you talked about a mentor, my mentor is probably my first instructor, and his name is Diego. I've totally lost touch with Diego. I have no idea where he is. I wish I could see that guy, because that guy was a great instructor. There were four instructors at the school I went through with my plane, and I went around asking people, who's the toughest instructor? And it was, hands down, it was Diego. They used to call him Diablo. And which he did not find that name funny at all, but they used to call him Diablo all the time. Diego was an Embry-Riddle hotshot. He used to fly Lear jets and corporate jets. He was one of these guys with just a lot of time in high-performance aircraft. Mm-hmm. And I remember looking outside, and whether it was bad weather, I'd be in that car out to the airport. Diego, can we go up in this? And I remember, I just have an image one time going in, and Diego literally had his feet on the desk, and he was reading the paper, and nobody was working. You know what it's like in flight schools, and it's raining, nobody's working. They're just sitting around, mm-hmm. you know, shooting the breeze. So
right.
He's kind of laughed at me. He goes, you want to go up in this? I said, yeah, well, if we can, absolutely. He goes, sure, we can go up. And of course, it was great to have Diego, who, as you know, is a pilot yourself. Diego's flying plenty of IFR, so he knows
right.
it. And he used to took me up in some of the worst turbulent, and these are pretty bad turbulent days. Even remember some of the days we went up, pretty nasty. I remember him landing that plane, and that thing was getting kicked all over the place. But I felt comfortable, because Diego, he was laughing. He was like, oh, he was laughing at how much it was getting rocked around. Very confident pilot. But he taught me the best lessons. Diego continued to do with me is he constantly pulled my throttle. Where are you going to land? Nope, too late. And I'm like, what do you mean too late? He goes, you already should know where you're going to land. And so this went on and on. And it was, I was kind of getting really annoyed by it. It was like just repetitive. You're up there and boom, where are you going to land? And I'm like, geez, I don't know. And he goes, too late. And he'd actually let me go way down, like above the field and stuff mm-hmm. like that. Actually, probably was not legal what we're doing, but it was great training. And he kept saying, you're flying a single engine airplane. You've got to know that you always have a safe landing space. And he taught me about crossing the Long Island Sound. You have to cross at the shortest point. You make sure that you're crossing at an altitude. I have to do all the calculations, glide ratios that I have to mm-hmm. make it to the shore. And it didn't hit me until my first cross country. I remember going down south. I was kind of feeling uncomfortable for some reason. Just saw thick forest. And I was thinking, oh, I got nowhere to land around here. And I wasn't really, as a very low time pilot, I wasn't really thinking that way. And I remember thinking, geez, you know, I either have to fly someplace else or I have to fly a lot higher. And he gave the instinct to me to always have that. And that's coming pretty handy because there have been these little times you have little situations that could be an emergency. They turn out to be not an emergency. One time I was flying the Comanche and it was my first reaction was gas. But actually, I'll say my first immediate instinctual reaction was I'm okay because the terrain down there was landable. Those are the things that I remember Diego, and he was just very hard on me, just very demanding. And I was so glad I picked him. So, and I think incidentally that attitude has to continue, even though like right now I'm constantly thinking of who can I fly with, continue beating me up, people who are better than me at doing aerobatics and stuff like that. Right. I'm not really interested in doing aerobatics. I like flying for just flying, but I'm probably going to learn aerobatics only because it pushes the envelope. Mm-hmm. And your IFR rated, I'm halfway through my IFR, that pushed the envelope. My landings actually improved in the first 10 hours of my IFR training.
All right.
I found it was like, wow, I can really just lock on the center line a lot more instinctually. Mm-hmm. And that's because of all that instrument training. So, yeah, I'm really into that constantly keeping you out of the comfort zone.
Definitely. Yeah, I certainly believe in that too. And we've actually talked about that a lot on the show and in several different episodes where you constantly need to be challenged. You need to have great mentors like you had with Diego. And it, you know, even if you don't have a Diego in the cockpit with you, you need to be pushing yourself as well, you know, to be better and do better and be more precise and just be a better pilot. I mean, there's a lot to be said for that.
Yeah. And if you own an airplane, making that checklist the best it can be. I mean, I've got my own homemade checklist based on the Piper checklist, but I've been flying the plane for 2 years and I added something about 4 months ago. But I mean, that mm-hmm. kind of stuff, constantly right. bettering yourself.
Definitely. Because there are little things about your workflow in your own airplane that are going to be different. And there are even things that, you know, maybe are a modern thing where you're dealing with an iPad in the cockpit or some sort of flight plan, filing a flight plan, something like that, that maybe could work its way in your checklist as well. So, and even that little nugget of information is helpful.
Yeah.
So let's talk about A2A. You are the founder of A2A, I assume, right? So let's talk about the startup story. Tell us about how you got started with A2A and kind of how you guys went through your history until where you are now, kind of. Let's go through that. I know that's kind of a big mouthful and it'll take a little bit, but I guess that's what we're here for.
A2A began maybe 13 years ago, and I was at SIM headquarters. I was on the staff at SIM HQ. We were flying these air combat sims, and I was never satisfied with the visual effects I always felt the visual effects were terrible. I remember contacting a developer once, and no point mentioning him today. He's actually still working today. And I remember calling him on the phone and said, hey, you know, why don't you have the smoke last a little bit longer after you drop a bomb? Mm-hmm. And I said, he goes, what do you mean? I said, well, you know, I just drop a 2,000-pound bomb. Don't you think I'm going to be able to look over my shoulder and see where the bomb is to make a second run? I just kind of mark the target. And this guy gave me the BS response of, it's too much horsepower on the engine to keep that plume of smoke going up that high. And I thought to myself, well, the guy just obviously doesn't have his priorities straight. He doesn't have his basics straight. I mean, I don't care if you're giving me circles. You don't have to give me realistic smoke, but you got to give me some smoke that I can see. All I had was this little decal of a crater that I couldn't find mixed in.
Of course.
And so I finally had enough, and I went to Microsoft Combat Flight Simulator 2, which incidentally is very similar flight modeling to FSX, is sort of the roots of FSX. Mm-hmm. We were really into the flight models in air combat. It was all about realistic aircraft performance. But at that time, it was also about visual effects, because anything that's immersion killer, and the visual effects were just so bad. So I basically made I spent about a month, and I just made these little updates, and I put them out on the internet. It got really popular, and I was really surprised by the popularity, and everyone's saying, God, these effects are so good. And I'm thinking to myself, why are these effects so popular? Can't people see that they're really bad? Then one guy named Andy at SimHQ, he said, Scott, I've used your effects pack, and I recommend that you go into this as a career. He goes, I think you have what it takes. And I tell you, I took Andy's advice. I began to think that, geez, maybe these things that seem so obvious, I was assuming that everybody knew and everybody saw. But obviously they didn't, because of course the effects would be better. You see, kind of an illogical way to think about it. If they saw this stuff, then I wouldn't be looking at them thinking they look so bad. So we made Firepower. It was an add-on for Microsoft Combat Flight Simulator 3. Mm-hmm. It was supposed to be a weapons and explosion pack. I just wanted to have proper, realistic weapons. I mean, with proper physics, I was studying the size of the fireball, studying the size of the shockwave and how far it would go out and what it would affect. And I was getting involved in all sorts of stuff, a penetration of armor-piercing weapons, incendiaries, high explosive, all that stuff. And it's all great stuff. Then we started bringing on modelers. And incidentally, Rob Rogalski, he was the first one I worked with in Flight Sim. And I remember looking out there, I did a search for all the people making airplanes, and there was everybody else, and there was Rob. It was really that simple. There was the masses, and they were at I don't want to speak badly, but they're at a very low level. It's very imperfect. Flight Sim back then was just amateur modelers. None of these people had any experience with modeling. They just had a passion for making airplanes good, and they just decided to get the latest freeware modeling thing, and they would go. Rob was very different. I remember he told me, he said, he made a Messerschmitt 410, and it was absolutely gorgeous. I remember he had the screenshots. He made himself a website, and I asked him. He said it took him 8 months to make that. I might be wrong, and that might be longer than that. But he said 8 months to make the plane.
Wow.
And it was his first airplane he made.
Wow.
I mean, that's like seriously dedicated, intelligent approach and disciplined, highly disciplined. And that is Rob. He's highly disciplined. And I just teamed up with Rob, and we basically created a nucleus back then. And then we teamed up with a guy named Jay, and he was flight modeling, and he was outstanding. He was meticulous. He interviewed pilots after pilots after pilots. So it really kind of became a trio at that point, and we were creating products. And right, it just continued onward. But I'll tell you, we've always had our face to the wind, always been pushing the envelope. But back then, we were the new kids on the block, and we were really changing just the environment. First, from a visual point of view, Rob's stuff was just, it was earth shattering. It was like, how does he do this? And the thing about it, we had a team of like 7 modelers, and Rob was so well respected. I was concerned that his models were so good, and they were, that he would have demotivated the entire team. But it didn't work that way. Somehow he motivated everybody.
Yeah.
He was so respectful of working with him. Everyone loved working with the guy. And there was Rob's model, and there was everyone else. And we're working with Rob, the entire team brought it up a couple notches, and all the models benefited. And we used to have a little game we'd play. If we'd say, how many polys? The modeler would post a screenshot, and he'd say, how many polys? And Rob would do that. And everyone was guessing approximately 2 times the polygon count. And they're like, are you kidding me? What 14,000 polys? How is it possible? And then Rob would show them the techniques. You have to be a simulation/gaming artist. You have to understand. And that's Rob. He's been insane on getting good frame rates. And he also worked with a very low power computer. All through those years, Rob was using an underpowered computer, and he said he did not want to upgrade because he wanted to make sure that the planes flew right. And now we have Michal and we have Marcello, and they all work together as a team. We don't like to boss each other around. We all like to sort of pretty much be equals in the team and working like that.
Great. Sounds like a startup mentality, kind of, and I think the longer you keep that mentality too, the better. Good way to operate.
Yeah. Everyone knows what they're supposed to do, so it's they have their specialty. They do it. They're the best at what they do.
So what's the product history from there? So you worked in combat flight simulator a bit, more than a bit, I'm sure.
We were making great products. But we had signed up with a very bad publisher that went out of business, and they owed us a lot of money. And when they go out of business and they're out of a country publisher. So we started racking up a lot of debt years ago. Mm-hmm. And then the brick and mortar market started really sort of slowing down, and you print up copies of a game or a sim like a particular heavy bombers and jets or World War II fighters. You start shipping these things out. If they only sell 50% through, the other 50% come back. They end up bargain bin, and before you know it, you're just getting pennies on the dollar.
Right.
It just was an absolutely miserable way to do business, and it's good riddance to brick and mortar and publishers. Goodbye. Yeah. The moment they started receding into the background, A2A started growing because we're now speaking directly to the customer.
Mm-hmm.
We were making that 377. It was supposed to be out in December, I remember. And as I was going through each of these systems, I was like, okay, we got to replace the manifold pressure because this is not right. This is not the way manifold pressure works. I don't know how they're doing it, but I don't have time to reverse engineer what they're doing. Let's just make a new manifold pressure. Can we do it? Yeah, sure, we can do that. Okay. Then it kept going and going and going, and it was going on and on and on. And we eventually went around that entire Stratocruiser cockpit. And that's a big cockpit with a lot of systems. And we replaced everything. So Everything was now out of FSX. And by that time, we had created AccuSim. We didn't realize it until it was sort of halfway through. We said, guys, we're really creating something. This is a whole new simulator here. This is no longer FSX. This is AccuSim. But then we thought 20% of our customer base was going to want AccuSim.
Mm-hmm.
And 80% was just going to want to fly a pretty plane and look at it and have fun. And that
was the opposite,
reversed.
Wasn't it?
It was the absolute opposite. 80% of the people on day one reached for the additional AccuSim pack. And that aircraft was not cheap. And that sucker came out on day one. That was by far our most successful opening day. And when that day happened, you know, it's you have an intuition you work by. You have this little voice inside you that tells you when something's possible, when something's not, so you know when to stop or know when to forge ahead. Mm-hmm. There was that day. By the end of that day, I was a new person. I was a new man on that day, because I saw the money coming in, and I realized we can do this. We can get this company out of debt, and we can succeed. And I realized, guys, we can't make another mistake. And I'm not saying we're human and everyone makes mistakes, but we no major mistakes since then. And every plane since then, the Cub and the P-47 Thunderbolt and all the Warbirds and the GA. And so, yeah, AccuSim. And that was it. And of course, it just allows us to get to it. We have our own environment, our own working engine. I mean, the engine, as you know, is a physical engine. From the get-go, there's no engine on and an engine off variable. Mm-hmm. And it's a variable that coders will use to say, well, is the engine running? Because if the engine's running, we want to do this.
And by engine, you mean game engine, just for the listeners, right?
No, we're talking about the physical engine in the plane. Like you're flying a Piper Cherokee. It's got a Lycoming 360 in it, the 180, right? At some point, the engine's running, and at some point, it's not. Well, in Flight Simulator, there is it's like a light switch. When you hit the starter, is everything there? Is the fuel there? Is there enough electricity? If everything's just check, 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 everything's good, then it says, okay, engine combustion equals one. And as soon as it equals one, then it says to the engine, run the startup sound. Then you got this recanned startup sound. They go, blah, 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 it goes. And then once that thing, it says fade the startup sound out and then run the idle sound or whatever you happen to be at. And that's the way it starts up. It's a light switch. But in AccuSim, there's clearly no light switch. There's no such thing as an engine running or not. There are pistons that go up and down with spark plugs. Well, actually, there are pistons that go, and valves that open that go up and down, and they suck in the air and the fuel, and it takes it from that. And if the air and the fuel is being sucked in at a certain speed, that's great enough. The cylinder might fire, and there's a lot of different variables based on whether that cylinder is going to be firing, whether it's fuel distribution. All this stuff sounds kind of crazy. Your listeners might think, well, what does it matter? The end result is you have an engine that feels exactly like a real combustion engine. And anybody that's driven a car, has used a lawnmower or a snowblower or a leaf blower or anything, chainsaw, anything you've done, we have an inherent sense of a combustion engine. We know it's almost like a living organic machine, thing. It's a machine.
Right.
And we know when it sounds good. You know when it's running too high. You know when it's not running right. If it's skipping, you know when it's running smooth. And then, of course, you have an airplane engine, which are just a bunch of these pistons all tied together, spinning a crankshaft that's spinning a propeller. And then actually the Spitfire was the first time we did the new propeller physics. So it first kind of happened with the Stratocruiser. Then we replaced the sound engine completely with the P-47, which is awesome. Suddenly you could open up the canopy and you got all that wind and the engine was all good. And then the Spitfire did the propeller and we kept going more and more. The P-40 was the hydraulic system. That's when we created the AccuSim hydraulic system and then it went on and on from there.
Gotcha. Now, just to clarify for the listeners, AccuSim is essentially A2A's way of hijacking all of the terrible wrong things that Microsoft Flight Simulator or whatever simulator you're working in does and basically does it realistically. Like you said, it's actually taking into account the pistons moving. It's taking into account all of these things that are going on behind the scenes to actually make the engine run. And really, that's not just in the engine. That is with many, many different operations in aircraft systems, in how it flies through the air. Yeah, basically you're taking everything over. Am I right in making that assessment?
Everything. Absolutely. The entire airplane is recreated. We're getting into, I think it's like year 7. This is a mature working system that includes the electrical system is proper. There are things that happen in AccuSim planes that only happen in AccuSim planes because we coded it in there based on our observations of actual, airplanes and things like that. And the cool thing is also when you have that physics engine actually drive and create and generate the sound. In fact, the AccuSim engine sound, it's actually generated by the pulses of the pistons and the explosions. So it makes a consistent sound. The actual engine sounds themselves do not have any skipping. There's no rough-running engine. But if you actually were to be flying an AccuSim plane, and in the highly unlikely scenario where you'd say a cylinder might crack or something. You might lose all compression in a cylinder. But that's what happened to my Warrior. I mean, you really knew that immediately. And you could hear that like that. And that's what Accusim would do. The engine sound would suddenly go blah, 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 like that.
Wow.
But it's only doing that because, say, the number three cylinder is not firing. So the engine's going to lose a little bit of momentum. It's now going to be out of balance. So you're going to be shaking the airframe. That airframe is going to be shaking the gauges and all the things that are attached to it. So you're going to get some shaking in there. You're going to hear the engine going vuh, 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 like that. And you're actually, if it's shaking the airframe enough, you might hear the airframe shaking. So there's a lot of little things that might happen, but they're all happening dynamically. It's truly simulating the physical interactions of what's going on in an airplane, in the engine, in the propeller, in the controls, in the way the wings respond, especially in slow flight as well. That's the other thing where Accusim has basically increased. It just makes slow flight, you're a pilot,
it's one of the only planes you can do slow flight in a simulator and realistically do it, you know. Otherwise, it's not like the real thing at all.
Yeah, that's actually one of the Microsoft guys. They've always been big fans of our work from the original team, and that's just exactly what the guy said to me. He was asking me how do you do it, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And you're making the planes fly like that when it gets slow.
Well, we hijacked your what you guys were doing, and we're doing it correctly now. So.
Well, I'll tell you, the Microsoft team was always incredibly mature and respectful. And I have always tremendous respect for them. And
as a team, as people, they are fantastic. It's really Microsoft as a business that we're holding them back from doing special things.
Well, that's a whole different situation.
Yeah. Right.
No, the individual. But I mean, I always felt like I don't really like it when people, like, as an artist, I don't like when people muck too much with things that I've created as an artist. It's like, mm-hmm. you created a painting and someone goes in and just decides to change the color of the house.
Yeah, that reminds me when someone makes a really nice meal and then you just, you know, you grab your plate of food and then put seasoning all over it. That, it kind of reminds me of that too. I always find that insulting. And so when I'm at someone's house having dinner, like, I don't do that to people, you know. It's like, this tastes good, just how you made it. I'll just have it this way.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So that's one thing I really notice about your airplanes when I go in and fly them in the simulator is, you know, really a lot of these little details are in there that you just don't get anywhere else. But it comes from this core functionality, which is Accusim, where it's all just being done realistically. And you as a pilot, you know, most of it's transparent to you. You don't know what's going on behind the scenes, but you know, unlike other airplanes, you know, in this airplane that whatever you do is going to have consequences. And even the simple things, like the other day I was sitting on the ramp, I was taking too much time trying to figure out why the heck the airplane wouldn't start up. Because, you know, I'm not used to a 172 with fuel injection. So I was trying to figure all that out and find out what I had broke realistically in the simulator to get that fixed. And then my window started to fog up. And I was sitting there for too long in the cockpit, and it started to get hazy. And so what I did was I looked over and I opened my side window there, and then the fog started to go away in the cockpit. So all those little immersion factors just really play to the believability of the simulation. And really, I mean, that's what you're after at the end of the day. If you can achieve that and help the pilot forget for even a few seconds that this is not real.
That's it.
Yep.
I call them immersion killers. Mm-hmm. You can make something great, but if you have an immersion killer in there, like, let's just say the propeller animation doesn't look right. That's an immersion killer. You're looking at the propeller all the time. You never can lose yourself in the simulation if the propeller doesn't look right.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, wait a minute, that's not a propeller, that's a graphic. So you're spot on with that. That'll ruin a huge team effort. Most people would hopefully kind of look beyond that, but they'd be really pounding on it. Hey, guys, you got to do something about this stupid propeller. It's driving me nuts. They don't look like this, you know, that kind of stuff.
And it goes way back, right? It goes way back to that smoke from that explosion that you were talking about with that other developer that, you know, this just makes sense. Why doesn't it look the correct way? So you guys do a fantastic job with just so many of those little details in the airplanes.
It's one thing to be, you know, a pilot. Okay, that's one thing. It's not necessary to be a pilot to make a great simulator, but it helps. Mm-hmm. It definitely puts the icing on the cake. But it's the observing, I think, where most people fall short. They fail to observe things that, like you said, the smoke. You know, sometimes if the smoke isn't, you know, wait a minute, smoke doesn't swirl like that. It doesn't go, it's kind of, it moves around like this and it fades. It doesn't just kind of fade out and go pop and pop out. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of stuff I'm talking about, you know.
Right.
So, yeah.
So, what are you guys working on these days? Because you guys kind of moved from doing a lot of this warbird stuff. It kind of seems like a natural transition through the years. You know, you went from doing the combat flight simulator stuff, and then you grew up and started doing these warbirds within Flight Simulator, Microsoft Flight Simulator, and then you came out with the little tail dragger. Tell us kind of from that little tail dragger to where we are now. And I know what it is, but I'm going to let you talk about it.
Were you talking about the J3?
Yes, yeah.
Well, I first just want to make clear, you know, when we look at airplanes, we just see a flying machine. I see it all the same, whether it's a jet or whether it's a propeller or whether it's a twin, even could be, even be a rocket sitting on a launch pad. You're talking about aerodynamics and propulsion. So a lot of people think, oh, you've kind of gone away from warbirds. It's like, well, look, we love warbirds.
Of course.
But we love warbirds because they're fantastic airplanes. Mm-hmm. We don't have to shoot guns to be entertained by a warbird. And the way I look at it is if most people are just excited to sit inside of a warbird, let alone fly it.
Oh, yeah.
So if somebody goes inside your simulator and they're not excited to look around the cockpit, then you got to stop. And let's not even go past this point. This is where, you know, the Rob came in when we first started making, you know, the models way back when.
Right.
Is that that's got to be exciting. And then, of course, it's exciting to start even a Cessna 172 in real life. Mm-hmm. So if it's not exciting in the sim, you're really missing something. It might not be shaking right. It might not be squeaking or rattling. So we are every bit as crazy about warbirds. So we ended up doing the J3. Trying to think where the inspiration on the J3 came from. I think it was we really wanted to. A lot of people before the J3 were thinking, "Oh, AccuSim, it's just damage modeling. I don't want that. I don't want to go through all the realism hassle." And unfortunately, we were being painted with the same brush that people were experiencing from developers prior to us that used the term realistic or authentic. And all that meant was it's too hard and I have no fun flying this thing. And it's too complicated. It's not well designed. It's got to have an intuitive interface. It's just not fun. And the fact is planes are fun, period. A glider is fun. A J3 is fun. Mm-hmm. So if it's not fun, and they're easy too. Easy. A J3 is like a model airplane. It's like, yeah, an electrical an system engine in it, right? I think what we did is we said, screw it, we're going to AccuSim a J3. And the exact response we got was what we were expecting. J3? What's to AccuSim? I was like, well, I guess you're going to have to just wait.
Right.
And when that thing came out, we never heard that again. That what's to AccuSim never came out again. It was a very popular product.
So maybe that's where the light went on for everyone, where they really truly understood what AccuSim was doing.
For most people, yes. They still tend to think real equals complicated, where I think real equals easy. I think bad physics equals complicated. That's mm-hmm. complicated to me.
Trying
to do a proper landing, flare the aircraft and landing and not getting the proper, you know, feel or, you know, stalls mm-hmm. and stuff like that. So, so we did the J3. And the reason why we got into general aviation, the Cessna, was primarily because of the Comanche purchase, the Piper Comanche. which really got me back into active aviation. I stepped out of active aviation because I have a family, and it just was expensive to keep it going. Well, the kids have kind of grown up, and it became harder and harder for me to really push further than we needed to. We went very, because I'm a pilot, but I wasn't really actively flying like 5 years ago.
Right.
So I got really back into it big time and decided to get a complex high performance plane and get all that experience. And the goal with the Comanche was 2 years. In 2 years, it was 18 months. I gave myself 18 months to get to know this airplane backwards and forwards. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me when I was a kid of my Pontiac Trans Am, because I built the whole thing. Everything that was on that car, I bolted it on. The whole interior, the whole dashboard, the instruments, everything. I had fenders off and engine out numerous times, transmission, brakes, you name it, exhaust, the whole thing. Now, I wanted to know the Comanche like that Trans Am. And I'm happy to say, well, the Comanche is actually a lot more complicated than a Pontiac Trans Am. You know, 2 years later, I know a lot about this airplane. I mean, I know as much as about this airplane as anybody I know. So that's where I wanted to be. And I wanted it to be, like I said, a high-performance, traditional, complicated, like a Bonanza. It could have been a Bonanza. Or right. It could have been a Comanche. And I was looking at Bonanzas as well. It would have been the same difference. So I just needed to be very much at home with all the systems. It was a great move. It was, I was a little apprehensive at first, thinking, you know, this is a big investment. You know, we make sure we're doing this right. I don't have to really buy. I could actually rent and I played it. But what a great move, because when you own the plane, you care about everything, especially right. when you're flying your family in that plane. You got to make, that's why I'm saying, I can't have anybody touch the plane and just have to know what was done. I got to check over the work, make sure that it was, you know, things were put on right. It's not a lack of trust. It's I'm not willing to take any chances of right. something going wrong. But it's this persistence that got me into the mechanics and helped immeasurably with the Cessna 172. And Redbird Simulations, who does a lot of professional simulators throughout the United States and the world, were bugging us for years to do 172. And I said, guys, it's just not the right time. We're not there right now. We're working on something else. We were working on a P-51 at that time. And the time finally came. And I gave them a call. I said, guys, guess what? We're making a 172. And they were like, hooray, you know, great. So we said, hey, you know, we're going to put it out. And whatever we put out to the public, we can license back to you guys and you can use it. Oh, and it was the Cub spinning. The spinning of the Cub was the reason why Redbird. And they actually used our Cub. Yeah, it was the spinning. They said, how do you do it? They go, I don't know how you do this, but we need that kind of dynamic in the right stalls. On. So the 172, and we did it because that was the most popular plane and most people would know how it flew and it would really hold our feet to the fire and it would really force us to put out the absolute. There's no way we could get away with anything being off without some guy, some instructor, and there are a lot of instructors that fly it. And in fact, at Oshkosh, you just would not believe the amount of people who just didn't realize this fidelity was possible. And there are instructors who are coming out there and flying right. and from various flight schools and stuff like that. And they want the plane. They want it. And so then the Cherokee, was my first plane. And I love the Cherokee. I think it's one of the greatest airplanes ever made. I mean, you consider what it does, what its mission was, and how it accomplished it. Mm-hmm. You could say the same thing about the Cessna 172, and you can actually say the same thing about the Cessna 182 that we just put out for all very different reasons. And we knew we were going to get hit with this. Oh, the 182, isn't it just a big Cessna 172? And they look very similar when you and even to an experienced eye, if you kind of scan the airport, you might mix up a 182 with a 172 and the high wing Cessnas. But as soon as you start walking up to the plane, and then as soon as you open the door, and then of course you start the engine, and all that stuff, you realize, wow, this is definitely not a 172.
Right, yeah.
I was so happy. I've always wanted to fly a Skyline. It's just for all these 2 years, fly my Comanche, and I love my Comanche, but we have a lot of Skylanes out there. And you see these owners, and the Skylane is not an aircraft you can rent commonly. It's very uncommon to find rentable.
Yeah, that's true.
And so I just didn't have any opportunity to fly them, you know, and but I always loved that big bulbous, you know, nose in that thing, and it's just a tough looking airplane. And so I found one up in Bedford, Massachusetts, had the G1000 in it. And I was really trying to find a steam gauge version, really hard. I found one that was further away, but it wasn't the T, it was the S. I wanted to fly the T. And I said, okay, fine. We'll do the G1000. I flew up there and got checked out and all that stuff. And I'm actually glad I did, because when it came to doing the flight dynamics, the G1000 had tremendous benefits for its precision. Of course, it records everything on a per degree accuracy. So you put the camera right on that G1000. I mean, even if I wanted to, it's got the USB. You can actually take the USB and plug it in and look at the actual data. But what I did is just stuck a camera right on both of those G1000s, high def, and kept the pages up. So I was able to grab things like cylinder head temperature behavior and warm-up times and all sorts of great information and a great avionics.
And to me, the 182 separates itself from the 172 in that you're kind of getting outside of it being a training aircraft, and now you're getting into it being a commuter aircraft or kind of an IFR workhorse. And that's how I personally approach this. And yeah, the 172 is still very useful for me. I can still go up and I can do training flights in it, things like that. But the 182, that's where IFR starts to get really, you know, quite realistic and actually doing those long cross countries, especially with a lot of the integration that you guys have with some of the aftermarket GPSs on the that are integrated, where you can just go in and enable them. So it starts to become really easy to do that.
Was a big team effort on that one, and a lot of work, you know, contacting everybody, making sure everything works right. And people were hounding us about it in the forums. They really wanted it, and they're trying to explain, geez, you know, it's not that easy to support this stuff. But no, I'm very, very proud, to be part of the organization and to have put what we just put out. You always get nervous before a release. You just never know how, you know, the biggest fear is a big bug that got through. Fortunately, that didn't happen, and it usually shouldn't happen, but you always have that fear, or something crazy happens at launch. You know, maybe people aren't getting the zip files or something, or they get corrupt. So you have to do all these checks. But the launch went very smoothly, and from what I'm reading, everyone's responding. They get it. And you're a bonanza flyer, so you look at the 182 with equal respect. I mean, the thing is just a phenomenal airplane.
And it has its own separate mission, you know. There are things the 182 and the Cessnas can do that the Beechcraft or the Bonanzas can't do, and it's funny that now they're kind of the same company, but realistically they come from a different lineage.
Yeah.
But the 182, it's a fantastic airplane. So along those lines, it's been received well. It seems like it has. It seems like a lot of people are creating their own repaints for it, things like that. It seems like they love it.
We had to really go deep into the cylinder head temperature, the exhaust gas temperature, and the variable speed prop. AccuSim models the engine efficiency, the low RPM, high manifold pressure relationship, which actually, you know, you don't get on like the modern aircraft, like the Cirruses and the Lancer. You've got that single lever approach.
Mm-hmm.
I might be wrong. And actually, does the Lancer have a single lever?
I don't know.
Flown one.
I don't know. Yeah, it depends. It depends on if they have a FADEC or not. But
even like all the new diesel engines that are coming out, this is a lever.
Diesels are all FADEC. Yeah.
I love diesel engines, but I personally want to run the engine at the lowest possible RPM, at the highest possible manifold pressure for that RPM, because the engine just runs. To me, it's quiet, and that's the way the engine wants to run. And we, with these older technology planes that we have that have the prop lever, you know, I'm not against technology. I know it's all going out there, but it's too bad they don't have some sort of override, because I'd be overriding it all the time. My Comanche, my favorite cruise setting is 1,800 RPM, 25 inches. That's my cruise setting.
Oh,
some people are like, oh, you're crazy. That's so over square. It's going to be so bad for the engine. It's like, you know, tell that to my mechanic. I've got a great compression. I burn very little oil and the engine is just purring and it's loving it. Lycoming's okay with it. I've contacted the engineers there. And the people who are in the know will say, actually, that's the best way to run the engine.
Right,
so
yeah.
I want people are now for the first time experiencing that. And if you will, if you were to dial in and even go by the charts, 2,000, 2,100, 2,200, 2,300 RPM, and dial in the same percentage of horsepower. So you say you want to do a 60% horsepower, 2,400 RPM, and 60% horsepower at 2,000 RPM. You'll produce the same horsepower in the same speed, but the difference is the one at 2,000 will be burning less fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is that's fantastic. And it's quieter. I love a quiet cockpit. I don't like having the cockpit screaming loud the whole time and everyone getting vibrated to death in the aircraft.
And it's even worth a couple of extra knots, you know.
Yeah, yeah, and I like
just to enjoy the experience and not get rattled to death.
No, I love pulling that prop back. As soon as I'm wheels up, I'm bringing it back to 24 squared. Almost immediately, and then I'm sort of climbing out, and then as soon as I'm getting to like 1,000 feet, I'm already dialing that thing back, especially in the hot weather, because the cylinder head temperatures keep going up and up and up and up, and of course they have the cylinder head temperature behavior now, so they're experiencing the same thing. And the cowl flaps, it's another system that you have to get in your head,
right?
You have to have part of your operation or use of your workflow.
One last question I want to ask you before I let you go is, what do you think the future of flight simulation is? Where do you see it going?
We have a very clear idea where we're going. And I guess that's one of those questions that, God, I don't really want to answer because this is stuff that we talk about just internally where we're taking it. If I were to say, I think the next big thing in sim is X, Y, and Z, we're basically telling everybody out there, the competitors, where we're going. And we
I don't
can't
want you
do,
to
that.
Do that.
No, nor do we.
So speaking of prepared, what are your thoughts on prepared as a platform for the future?
Prepared has been outstanding for the community and also for FSX, because prepared has infiltrated the military and the commercial industries. It's everywhere and it's entrenched and it's out there and it's a stable platform like the Redbird flight simulators. So when you have that strong professional industry based on Microsoft Flight Simulator X, we can now develop simultaneously for training and for entertainment. So the way we look at it is prepared is so solid in the professional flight training that it's virtually given almost infinite legs to FSX and vice versa. So if you're flying FSX and you like it, stick with it. You're great. Prepared's not going anywhere. And I don't think FSX is going anywhere either, because now we have Dovetail Games picked it up. Mm-hmm. And this can be going on Steam. So when you consider where FSX has come from, millions and millions of development dollars and man hours over the decades have sunk into that platform. And I don't think this flight sim is ever going to be seen on the level that we've seen, that we're seeing right now with both Prepared and FSX. So it's all great.
Great. Well, we're going to wrap up the show here. Do you have any other final thoughts or advice for would-be pilots or simulator pilots out there?
No, other than it's just a great time for flight simulation. It's been a great time for the last 5 years. It's been a great time, and I see the next 5 years being better.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we know it's going to be better. And also, you know, as a company, we've been growing every single year. So that's been a good thing too for Flight Sim.
Definitely. All right. Well, keep up the fantastic work. You guys are you're making waves here, and we like to see that.
All right, Chris. Thanks.
Yep. Thanks, Scott. See ya. Okay, so I hope you guys enjoyed that as much as I did. I've been trying to get Scott on the show for a while now. He and I finally met face-to-face after all these years at Oshkosh this last August. So it's finally good to have him on the show and learn a little bit more about his background and also see that they are having great success with their most recent products, and especially this most recent product with the 182. You know, I've put this aircraft and these aircraft in my simulator, and I really like this stuff. If I'm going to go out and I'm going to do some flight training maneuvers and some basic stuff, then this is the type of airplane that I want to fly. Now, saying that I'm going to go out and do flight training stuff and basic stuff, it doesn't mean that this is a basic aircraft. As with Scott's explanation throughout his interview, this is top-notch quality stuff. I mean, I am constantly doing things in the simulator that that get me consequences like I would get in the real world where, you know, I'm fouling up my spark plugs or I'm getting carbon deposits on my magnetos or not doing the pre-flight correctly to where my engine just doesn't start up or I didn't preheat my engine or, you know, all these little consequences that you really don't get from other simulations, you get with this stuff. And I really, really love being in there and being immersed in this experience. And it's actually something that you can't get from many airplanes, you know. And it just so happens that it's a great 172 and a 182. And as I mentioned, the 172 is a great training aircraft. I wouldn't go out and really use the 182 for training. I'd go out and I'd use it for cross-country type of flying and IFR type of flying because it's very capable in those scenarios. So that's kind of what we're looking at here. A2A, they make absolutely awesome quality products. You can check them out at a2asimulations.com. Scott, thank you so much for coming on the show. We really enjoyed having you, and we wish you all the best success in the future. We know that based on your track record, whatever you choose to do, it's going to be awesome. So we're really happy to hear that it's gone well so far, and we cannot wait to see what you come up with next because it will be up to A2A standard, which is a standard in and of itself. So again, thank you, and we hope to have you back on the show sometime. All right, now for some after-show AviatorCast actions. You can take a survey. You can take this quick two-minute survey by going to survey.aviatorcast.com. Here you can give us ideas for upcoming shows. I do monitor those, and I do use them. So that's how we come up with a lot of these interviews and a lot of these ideas. You know, outside of our own ideas too, but that's a place where you can kind of direct a show and share with us. Second, you can continue the conversation by joining us on aviatorcast.com or write me directly at me@aviatorcast.com. I love to hear from you in either location. I answer every email, so feel free to write me. Third, you can subscribe, and this is pretty easy. You can do this through iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, SoundCloud, a lot of other podcast apps out there, and grab this episode. And that way you won't miss another episode of AviatorCast. And last here, fourth, this kind of came up earlier. We had Anis write us from Istanbul. If you would like to leave a review, it'd be very much appreciated. You can do that on iTunes, or you can do it on our website somewhere there. But iTunes is the primary place. This is where most people learn about the podcast, and it's a great place to let people know about it. And you may even get your review read on the show because I do read the reviews on the show. So if you'd like to check out any of our training products here at Angle of Attack for flight simulation, you can head to flyaoamedia.com. Start with the basics for free with Aviator 90. Learn instrument flying and more with Aviator Pro, or even fly many of the world's most popular jets virtually with our training products for the 737, 747, 777, and MD-11, again at flyaoamedia.com. And for you A2A customers out there, you A2A 172 and 182 flyers, go ahead and check out Aviator 90 and Aviator Pro. I think those will be right up your alley. There's really nothing to lose with Aviator 90. It's completely free, and you get real knowledge from real pilots on how to fly, and you do that by watching great, entertaining videos. So go ahead and go sign up for that. Also, Angle of Attack offers professional video services at angleofattackpro.com. just write us there to talk about your project. We'd be happy to discuss that with you. All right, now in closing, many thanks go out to the Angle of Attack crew for all of their hard work to make this episode possible and all they do outside AviatorCast so that we can have great interviews with people like Scott. And most of all, thank you for joining us on this episode of AviatorCast. We are truly grateful to have you here, part of our community, and so engaged in this wonderful passion for flying things. Until next time, throttle along.
Cat 58 is ready. Cat 58 is short line, turn left heading 235. Maintain 2000, runway 25 right. Clear for takeoff.
Clear for takeoff, 25 right, United 580.